Hey guys, so for today's video, we're gonna be talking about sex, baby. Let's talk about you and me.
Our attitudes towards sex have become warped and perverted. There's just icebergs of filth floating through every house on Wi-Fi.
What happens when you're in a relationship and the one cheats on you?
Why am I always over here feeling alone and single and not supported?
Here I am being a good Christian, you know, doing what the God says.
It's one of those things where the pornography addiction turns into something else. You can't have something like that in your life without it growing into something else.
It just felt like something that we were forced to accept, and we never got a chance to have a conversation about it. That message that your sex is the thing that makes you valuable, that is your currency, that limits women's choices.
So if you're constantly bombarded with great waves of filth, it's really difficult to remain connected to truth.
I honestly think that those of us who are kind of in our 20s, 30s, living as unmarried people now, I honestly think that it's more difficult than ever to save sex for marriage. For me, I was probably 10 when I first saw porn, and have had, through periods of my life, real struggles with, you know, big addiction and the way you look at people and objectify people. It's made life a lot more difficult. My name's Matt, and I'm part of the team here at Metro, and for the last couple of years, I was the student worker here, not anymore, handed that over to Sam, and unbeknownst to me the whole time, one of the students had a bit of a thing for me, and I slowly started to kind of very reluctantly like her as well, and once I'd finished as student worker, we kind of started dating. And yeah, we've been together for about 6 months. Now, obviously, with all the best intentions in the world, if you're in a relationship with someone that you love and you're really attracted to, saving sex from marriage is a bit easier said than done. Now, actually, we haven't had sex, we're not planning on it. But actually, at times, there's definitely been times when you get really close to that boundary and it's really tough to kind of maintain that, and kind of in the heat of the moment, how do you remember actually, well, this is what we think is God's plan for us, when, you know, you're with this beautiful woman who you love, and yeah, there've definitely been times when we've kind of gone a bit too far with that, and you push boundaries a bit and you stop feeling guilty. And, you know, practically speaking, you know, obviously, when for both of us living in shared houses, the only time you can really get alone easily is if you're kind of locked up in each other's rooms. And it's like, in that kind of environment, like, obviously, you're not making it easy for yourselves. Towards the end of December, the beginning of January, had this bit of a kind of, not weird, but powerful moment where just almost out of the blue, felt like God's spirit was just poking me and saying, is this really it? Are you really living up to the standard that you've set for yourself? And just felt really convicted. It was a really powerful, I think, time for both of us. And since then, kind of spiritually, I've just been so much more almost like on fire in my own personal life. And I think as a couple as well, we've, you know, had times where we're praying together, and it just feels like it feels a lot more kind of serious. And obviously in that, you've got to kind of have practical steps to help each other out. So for us, it's, you know, even stuff that sounds a little bit lame, but so for instance, if we're hanging out in my house, we always have a little door stop in the door, make sure it's open so that you can't get too hot and heavy in there without someone bursting in, and which has happened before, thank you Alan. And as well, you know, if one of us needs to crash around the other's house, we won't stay in the same room or in the same bed, we'll sleep on the sofa or something like that. And, you know, for the two of us, both of our main love languages are quality time, so actually trying to get out and do something, so going for a walk out, even if it's cold and rainy and dark and horrid, actually for us, getting out and doing something, actually we know it's going to help our relationship and make us a lot happier than just staying in, moping around and kind of pushing boundaries or whatever. Yeah, so since giving over that area to God, we found at least that actually our relationship's so much more joyful, and it's so much easier to I feel like it's honestly easier to get to know each other better and to be, there's so much more room for actual emotional intimacy rather than just, I think sometimes there's this, we see intimacy as purely a physical thing, whereas actually the emotional side is just as, if not more powerful. And for us, I think it's been growing in that and finding the joy in growing in that side of our relationship. So I feel like, personally, God's been saying to me recently about like, calling me to live a godly, kind of pure life in the area of my sexuality. I feel like he's saying to me, actually, if you want to help build the church, see the church grow, see people become like Jesus and meet Jesus for the first time, actually, you need to be living godly lives if you want to see people meet God. So, yeah, that's the challenge I'd throw out to all of us. If you're someone who wants to follow Jesus, the call is there, kind of God set that mark. Are we going to try and live up to it? And, you know, especially if you're a leader, that's a big challenge for us, I'd say.
When I was 17 years old, I had the mother of all crushes, teenage crushes. I'd had infatuations, I'd had the odd crush, but 17 years old, Daisy Green, I was in big, big trouble. My situation was that I was at school, I was in an all-boys school, and it was a very godless school. So I was there as a Christian, trying to live a Christian life, and none of my friends, it was completely looked and frowned upon to be a Christian, but I was trying to do my best, and I struggled for a few years, but in the end, I was just falling in love with Jesus, and so I decided that I was going to do this Christian union, and I put it out, we're doing a Christian union, and no one came, so I pushed on, but really, Christian union, if you don't know, it's just like a Christian club at lunchtime, Friday lunchtime, geography classroom, thank you, Mr. Patterson, and that was just me. I was the Christian union. I made myself president, I was the treasurer, secretary, also the rebel, you know, always at the back, ignoring myself, then tell myself off, and it's weird. But we had a girls' school next to our school. Next to our boys' school, there was Queen Anne's, and Queen Anne's had a thriving Christian union. There was like 30 of them in this Christian union meeting every week. And as president, I arranged to have joint CU meetings. So I'm in this boys' school, and every Friday lunchtime in the geography classroom, this whole troop of girls would just wander down the corridors, and I'd let them in. Welcome, girls. They would all go in. I'd close the door. My friends would be looking at me. Half an hour later, we'd all come out smiling, giggling, and my friends were like, "What is your secret?" I'm just cool. And I had desire to tell my friends about Jesus and to live for Jesus and make a difference in my school. But, oh my goodness, one of those Queen Anne girls, Daisy Green, she was just the business. She was the epitome of the English rose. She was as beautiful as a summer's morning. She had this lovely kind of glowy skin, cheeks kissed with freckles. She had the whole package. She had like hair, strawberry blonde hair coming out of her head. Okay, I'm not a poet, I'm a preacher. And I saw her and I just developed this real, real crush. And I felt bad because it was like joint Christian union meeting. I genuinely wanted these girls, pray for me because I want to preach and tell people about Jesus. Pray for me. Let's have a prayer meeting for my school. And all I could think is Daisy Green, Daisy Green, Daisy, Daisy, give me your answer too. I am half crazy. And it was all about that. And I just couldn't get her out of my mind. And Fridays would be coming up and like, oh, I'm going to see Daisy. And it was distracting, really distracting. And it was like, I'm trying to be good here. And yet I find myself so drawn to this girl. Do I ask her out? Should I ask her out? Should we go on a date? Should I invite her to go out with me? Now, if you ask anybody to go out with you on a date, it's a difficult thing, it's a scary thing, it's a vulnerable thing. They could say no. I mean, it's never happened to me, of course. But, you know, this thing, what do I do? And I can remember this one Friday morning. It's Friday morning. I'm going to see her. She's going to be there. And all the room will just melt away, and it'll just be Daisy and her hair. And I'm praying, and I was sitting on my bed, and I was praying. And I was supposed to be reading the Bible passage for the day, but I couldn't get to it. I couldn't think. I couldn't focus. I'm praying, oh, God, please help me. I just need to know. I'm trying to do the right thing. I'm trying to be good. Should I go out with her? Should I ask? Is it okay for me to feel this way about her? Is this a distraction from me telling my friends about you? Please help me. I need some help here. God, I'm dying out here. Please. Okay, go. Nothing, nothing. No voice from heaven, no nothing, no picture, no sense, no nothing. I'm like, please, God, you gotta come through for me, please. If you've ever spoken to me before, speak to me now. Nothing. And after praying my little heart out, I just gave up and I said, fine, don't talk to me. I don't care. And I opened my Bible and I read this passage from 1 Timothy chapter 5. It says this: do not rebuke an older man harshly, but exhort him as if he were your father. Treat younger men as brothers, older women as mothers. And then the next thing that I read, literally, I am not making this up. I was so impacted, I not only shouted out, but I fell off the bed. It says, and younger women as sisters with absolute purity. And it was such a moment in my life. I'd been asking for God, how do I handle this? What do I do? And here came the answer, a verse that I don't think I'd ever read before, certainly never registered it before. Treat a younger woman like a sister with absolute purity. And actually, it helps me with the thing, and it helped me kind of gain a little bit of focus and perspective. And actually, I didn't ask her out. I decided to just focus on the mission of trying to share my faith with my friends. I started preaching. The first time I preached, 5 people came. 4 of them became Christians by the end of the preach. And we started seeing things happening in the school. But I thank God for that, because it became a guiding principle for my life, the purity principle. Treat someone like you would treat someone that you really, really love, that you really, really respect, that you really want the best for. But what does it mean to be pure? What does it mean to be pure? If you're a follower of Jesus, what does it mean to live with absolute purity? For those of us that are here not as Christians and maybe on the outside looking in, you don't need to kind of, this is something that you can just observe. But for those of us that have to live by this stuff, what does it mean? Because this whole thing about purity that is out there, sometimes in churches, people talk about purity, and you get the impression that anything that is to do with sexuality or desire or all of that kind of stuff is to be frowned upon. It's dirty. You shouldn't do it. You just put a chastity belt on, cover yourself with a sheet. Don't do anything. Be totally abstinent. And sometimes people treat purity as a kind of deal with God. Well, God, if I am pure, then you'll give me the most radically hot guy ever, hot woman ever, and that's the deal. What is purity? What does it mean? Does it mean that God is anti your expression, anti-sexuality? What does purity mean? And so when you look at Scripture, you'll see that actually the Bible defines what purity is. It's not about a restrictive thing. It's not about a repressive thing. It's not about some kind of outdated Victorian ideal? No, it's something about the way that we live well. The Bible helps us to live well, to do life well, and it gives us insight into how we should look at our relationships in the way that's going to be the most wholesome for us. And so Paul writes a letter because he writes about sex a lot, because he's living and he's ministering in a culture which is totally sex saturated. 2 of the books in the Bible, particularly Corinth, 1 Corinthians, 2 Corinthians, and then Thessalonians. The 2 Thessalonian letters that he wrote to the church in Thessalonica. Corinth, Thessalonica, ports, immoral, depraved places. In fact, we even have an expression for prostitute, which is a Corinthian girl. Those days, Corinthian girl, prostitute. So these were places of great kind of depravity, and the moral compass was just all over the place, and there was prostitution everywhere, and it was just the norm. And so Paul writes to Christians, followers of Jesus, and they're asking the question, how do we navigate this stuff? How do we live in this cultural moment? What's a good way, a godly way, for us to be Christian and yet be sexual and honor God? And so Paul writes this letter to these Christians, these early believers in Thessalonica, this Greek port. And he says, as for other matters, brothers and sisters, we instructed you how to live in order to please God. Everyone say, please God. This is about pleasing God. So this is the motivation. I don't want to just be some kind of holier than thou. I want to please God. How do I do that? Well, we gave you instructions how to live to please God, as in fact you are living. Now we ask you and urge you in the Lord Jesus to do this more and more. For you know what instructions we gave you by the authority of the Lord Jesus. It is God's will that you should be sanctified, that you should avoid sexual immorality, that each of you should learn to control your own body in a way that is holy and honorable. Everyone say, holy and honorable. Not in passionate lust like the pagans, it's just the surrounding culture, who do not know God, and that in this matter, no one should wrong or take advantage of a brother or sister. The Lord will punish all those who commit such things, as we told you and warned you before. For God did not call us to be impure, but to live a holy life. Therefore, anyone who rejects this instruction does not reject a human being, but God, the very God who gives you his Holy Spirit. That's an amazing passage. There's a lot in there. You need to kind of flesh it out and look at it. But there's one particular word, and I say this. If you missed the first episode, go back, go online, catch up on it, because it gives so much context, and we need the context. Otherwise, this can sound really hard and really heavy. But there's one word, and we're going to go there. We're going to look at what this word means. We need to define it. We need to know the terms that we're dealing with. But I'm fully aware that there will be people here, and maybe you don't have a Christian faith, or you've got very strong views of who Christians are and what they do, and you will find this hard to swallow. But all I'm asking you to do is just engage with us as we have a little conversation about this. Because there's a word that actually, even for the most ambitious of us to please God, it can hit hard. So let's just rewind and get back to that passage. So the word here, translated two words in English, is sexual immorality. And you need to ask the question, what does that mean? What exactly was Paul talking about, sexual immorality? And to look at it, the Greek word sexual immorality that he used was the word porneia. So you see this word porneia, it is where we get the root of the word porn, pornography. So if you ever wondered where pornography came from, it's basically graphy, writing or drawing of porn. Porn. So in the old time versions of the Bible, that word sexual immorality, porneia, was translated fornication. Everyone say fornication. Fornication. Sorry, just wanted to do that. Because it's like such a dirty, kind of loaded term. And we don't really use it. We don't really understand it anymore. And you need to know what the Bible is talking about when it talks about porneia. What is it? Well, this is the deal. Fornication, porneia, sexual immorality, it all indicates the same thing. And the Bible is incredibly consistent on this from cover to cover. And the best translation probably would just be extramarital sex. And so for all of you that think, yeah, that's exactly what I knew, that's exactly what I thought, Christians don't believe in sex outside of marriage. Well, that is kind of the deal. And that is the sexual ethic that the New Testament and the Old Testament comes for marriage and for sexuality. It elevates marriage and it elevates sexuality, and it says the best place for sex is within marriage. And sexual activity of any kind outside of that is actually something that you want to avoid. Now, you will have a whole ton of objections to that. And I know that. I get that, and I don't discount your objections. You'll say things like, well, sex is natural. You know, it's about my self-expression. It's just physical. Stop making a big deal about it. Stop being so just consumed with this. Get a life. It's just a physical thing. It's good for the relationship. It validates a relationship. Now, I'm not going to go into those first three reasons because we kind of looked at this last week. Apart from, I'll say this, when you find yourself in a committed, long-term, loving, stable relationship, You're not going to find yourself going to your significant other and saying, "Hey, honey, last night I slept with loads of people. But don't worry, it's natural. It's just an urge. I was just expressing myself. It's physical. It doesn't mean anything." Because you actually, you know that it is. There's more to it than that. We each have a morality around sex, what we think is acceptable, what we think is not acceptable, what we think is helpful, what we think is not helpful. So I'm not going to go into those because they're kind of, well, we dealt with them last week, but they're not really about relationship. These two ones I want to focus in on, the last two ones, because they're actually some really, really good objections. People say to me all the time, "Philip, the sex, it helps our relationship. You take sex out of a relationship between two people and you are limiting their choices. You're diminishing their ability to enjoy one another." I've had plenty of people say to me, "Philip, when we have sex, when I sleep with my boyfriend, when I sleep with my girlfriend, it makes the relationship better. We argue less. We don't kind of have difficulties and tension and conflict. Sex just kind of solves it, and it makes us feel close to one another." And taking it out, well, that's just you being condemning and shaming and critical. And I get that, and I can understand that. But some people will say this: the sex validates the relationship. How on earth can you possibly say only have sex within marriage? I mean, that's crazy. That's ridiculous. And again, I'm fully aware that if you don't buy into this, it is going to sound crazy. It is going to sound ridiculous. But people will say, how can you possibly keep sex for marriage? That's just a naive view of the world. You're going to do damage to people. You're going to send them with all these unrealistic expectations. They're not going to know what's hit them. And how do you know that you want to spend the rest of your life with someone if you haven't checked out whether you're sexually compatible? How do you know? How can you possibly walk down an aisle? Are you out of your mind? How can you walk down an aisle and exchange vows and you haven't seen whether you fit together? What happens if you're sexually incompatible? Sex is such a big part of us. Can you imagine a life without sex, a life where it doesn't work? That relationship's going to be miserable. Maybe you look at your parents, or maybe you look at another married couple and you think, "I don't want to be like them, some kind of sexless functional thing that I haven't seen it well." And you've seen broken marriages and broken relationships. The reason is that those relationships didn't work. They didn't put enough time into them. Some people will say, "You've got to get out there. You've got to find. You can't just marry the first person you fall in love with. You may change. You may develop as a person. I'm only in my 20s. I'm not going to settle down." And what I want to do before we go on to the whole thing about what purity looks like in our relationships, so I just want to take a bit of time to talk about relationships. I've been married to my wife, Kate, for 24 years. I think that deserves a round of applause. Thank you. That's a very polite round of applause. But listen, there's stuff that you need to know about relationship. Take it from someone who's been married 24 years. I got married when I was 10. It's, you know, kind of a big deal. But I want to share some stuff with you about relationships. And I want to draw on not just what the Bible says, because you know what the Bible says. The Bible says, avoid sexual immorality, avoid extramarital sex, the end, ban, come back up. Okay, we've done that bit. I want to talk about how relationships work. Why? Because that's what you want. You want relationship. You want to be the most important person to somebody. You want to be special to someone special, and you want to have them as special to you. We look for this. It's a natural human thing. What we're looking for is this kind of cheesy two hearts become one. We want that intimacy. We want the romance. We want a wonderful relationship. And I want you to get that, and I want to show you how to get it. Now, relationship experts will tell you, and this is all research-based, but they'll tell you that there's basically three components of any healthy romantic relationship. So there's passion, there is intimacy, and there's commitment. Passion, intimacy, and commitment, they're a kind of love triangle. They're a beautiful trinity, and they work together well. And you need to have these things working well in a relationship. If you're going to have a relationship that's going to go the distance, passion, intimacy, commitment, that's where it's at. Now, passion, what that does is it motivates the relationship. Passion is when you fall, and you fall hard for that person. It is when you are just obsessed, you're infatuated, you can't get over it. You know, I forgot about, what's her name again? Daisy Green. In fact, I'm going to be completely honest with you. Her name wasn't Daisy Green. I forgot her name because I got over it, you know. I moved on. It was just a hot flush. But when you meet someone, you can just go crazy. When I met Kate, I was 26 years old, and I met this girl. Her friend Derry, she came over. I went into this new church. I moved from Bristol. I went to Surrey. And I was introduced and taken kind of under her wing by Derry. Derry says, "Hey, you got to meet my friend. My friend's beautiful." And I'm like, "Yeah, every girl says her friend is beautiful." And then she introduced, and there Kate was. I remember she was in church, and we came from a row behind, and Derry just tapped her on the shoulder. She turned around, and I was in big, big trouble. Because indeed, her friend was beautiful. And when you're in this passion stage, it motivates you towards the relationship. You want to be close to them. You want to get to know them. You'll do anything for them. You're in this elevated state. It's incredible. And actually, I could not sleep. I could not eat. I could not drink. It was awful. And the worst thing was, when I asked her for a date, she said to me, "Can't we just be friends? Why can't we be friends?" I was rejected, and it still hurts, Kate. It still hurts. Why can't we be friends? I don't want to be a friend. I love you, okay? Forget friendship. Don't do that to me. I was motivated, though, because I had that passion. And when you have the passion, everything about that person is just golden. It's just like a halo around every slightest thing to do with them. You hear their name innocuously in conversation. You turn around. There's plenty of people called Kate. I was just like a yo-yo, my head turning around all the time, going in a dream, just doodling in the back of the exercise book, Kate, carve her name into random passerby. Just absolutely, and you know, I pursued her for 2 months. I was like, I've got to have this girl. I just need to be close to you. Can't you see? And I just went after this woman until finally she caved in and she went out. And then we really hit the kind of the passionate phase, because now I am close to her. And I can remember I'd be in the office, and I'd look down on my jumper, and there'd be a strand of hair. Oh, it's her hair! Oh, it's her hair! And I would go around the office and say, "Look, it's her hair!" And they'd be like, "Yeah, look, Philip, stop showing us Kate's hair. That's the fourth time this morning. You don't even work in this office. Your office is across the street." And I'm like, "I don't care. I'm in love. I have no concerns of such trivial matters." But everything about her, passion, really, really important. But it can burn out if it is not part of the kind of the trio. So the next thing is intimacy. Now, Matt, in the video, he talked about this. He talked about emotional intimacy. Two types of intimacy, the emotional intimacy and physical intimacy. They're both very important. They both build into the relationship. But that intimacy is, I'm motivated and I'm driven and I'm given a rush of adrenaline and energy to pursue a relationship. And then I find myself getting closer, getting intimate, building up shared experience, having that time, being, you know, there's nothing that feeds intimacy more than exclusivity. You know, it's just us against the world, and me too. And I remember some of the early dates Kate and I had. We'd be in the restaurant, and then it'd be so late, the waiters are kind of giving us the stink eye, putting chairs on the table. We're closed. "Yeah, but look, I've got another hair." And intimacy, you build intimacy. Now, the whole act of sex is part of a bonding, intimate, creating act that helps strengthen the relationship. And many people, all they do with relationships is they have the first two. They have intimacy and they have passion without actually taking it any further. But the third thing that you need, and you absolutely do need this, is commitment. So what commitment does, intimacy deepens the relationship. Commitment actually protects the relationship. And so commitment, when you commit yourself to each other, it protects you. Against all others, it protects you. I am here no matter what. It protects the relationship. And these are basically the things that are happening in relationship building. But that's the heart. I want to actually take it further because I think this is important for us to get to grips with. I want us to talk about some of the details about what's happening to us physically, not just emotionally with the heart, the two hearts intertwined. But everything that happens with your heart is mirrored with what happens with your brain chemistry. So let's just look at the brain for a moment. Because actually, we now have, thanks to modern science, we've got functional MRI scans, and you can actually track what's happening in the brain through these different relationship stages. So, for example, one researcher put a bunch of subjects into an MRI scan, giving them pictures and asking them questions about their loved one, and just watched the brain just light up all the time. And the parts of the brain that light up when you're in passionate stage of love, they're the same parts of the brains that light up when you're on crack cocaine. It is incredibly compulsive. It is incredibly addictive. That's why people can be in love with falling in love, be in love with being in love, because your brain just goes crazy. It is absolutely wired. And this stuff is incredibly powerful, it's motivational. And the parts of the brain involved, they're not rational, there's no reason. So all you see is good. You don't care about anything else. You don't see the flaws, you don't see the weaknesses. Yes, he doesn't have a job, but he's so wonderful. And we have a love like nobody's ever experienced before. And it's kind of crazy, it's irrational, and it comes from a very deep part of you, and it's exhilarating. But there's neurotransmitters and there's hormones that go through your body in relationship building. And they actually make you, they impact you, they affect you. That's why we say that sex needs to be connected back to who we are as people, as well as how we treat the world around us and our spirituality. So just, and this is incredibly simplified, but basically, a hormone is a chemical that runs through your bloodstream. A neurotransmitter is a chemical that runs through your nervous system. So you've got these neurotransmitters and chemicals, hormones, testosterone, dopamine, oxytocin. What oxytocin does is that it bonds people together. Oxytocin is called the cuddle chemical. When you are intimate, when you are close, when you hold hands, when you hug, when you are involved with one another, oxytocin is released. And it tells your brain, trust this person. Let down your defenses. This person is for you and you are for them. In sex, there's massive surges of oxytocin, which bond you to the other person. Oxytocin, which is released for a woman during breastfeeding and also after the birth of a child, it's this incredible thing. But here's an interesting thing. Dopamine is also produced massively during intercourse. And what dopamine does, again, this is the sex, drugs, and rock and roll chemical. It's a neurotransmitter in the brain, and it wires your brain. It's part of your motivation, the brain's reward system. And dopamine just says, yeah, yeah, do this again with this person. And there's a saying amongst people that look at the brain, and it's this: what fires together, wires together. So when you're getting the cuddle chemical, all those hormones saying, I want to bond with this person, and it's connected with dopamine, then it's firing together, it's wiring together. Your brain is saying, yes, 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 this person, this act. Sex becomes associated with this person, this context, this kind of environment that I am in. And it actually starts pathways within our brain. It affects our personality for good or for bad. Now, testosterone, that is released particularly for guys during the passion phase. Do you want to hear what this does? In the passionate phase, testosterone actually blocks oxytocin. So testosterone for guys, and I know that I'm generalizing here, and you know it'll be different for different individuals, don't shoot me. But for guys, testosterone tends to block the effects of oxytocin. So a guy can be in the passionate phase, and they can be sleeping with the girl and having all the dopamine and all this kind of stuff, but he's not so invested in the bonding part of things as a general rule. Do you know what releases testosterone in a man's brain? commitment. When a man makes a commitment, and again, I'm generalizing and I'm simplifying, but when you make a commitment, it reduces the levels of testosterone. When I first met Kay, I had so much testosterone flooding through my system. I'm like, Kay, I need you. I want to be with you. I'll climb a mountain. I'll eat a tank. I'll do anything. And then when you commit, it's like, I've reached equilibrium. And now all I just want to do is just to be with you. And so these things, they have a big, big impact on our lives. And the way that they work is that they feed into one another. So intimacy pushes us back into passion. But commitment also increases passion. So this whole thing about, you know, I don't want to have a relationship without sex. How do you know if you're compatible or not? It's actually not based on research. All the research overwhelmingly shows that actually deferring sexual intimacy builds relationship. Because if you just cycle between passion and intimacy, passion and intimacy, passion and intimacy, without commitment, you have worse relationship outcomes. It doesn't go that well for you. What we need is commitment, because actually commitment creates a good environment for passion and for intimacy. So cohabitation, the results, the research overwhelmingly shows that if you just live together with someone, you're 5 times more likely to break up than if you marry them. And weirdly speaking, and again, I know there are people that live together here, and this is not about you, but just generally speaking, couples that cohabit are actually more likely to divorce when they get married than couples who don't live together before marriage. We call it the cohabitation myth. It's totally counterintuitive. We don't think that way, but that's the way our brains and our hearts work. And so when the Bible talks about keeping sex within marriage, there's some wisdom here. There's some helpful things. One of my favorite pieces of research actually showed, it asked people, when did you get the highest level of sexual satisfaction? And the research showed highest levels of sexual satisfaction come 15 years into a relationship. So if you say, we need to be compatible, otherwise we can't live together, it's the other way around. Commitment will fire your passion. So, you know, just being completely vulnerable before you. For Kate and I, it was a number of years before it really started to click into place in a wonderful way. I mean, for me, it was good from the beginning. I'm a man. I'm just like, yeah. But for Kate, a longer time. Actually, being together and having that safety, that commitment of marriage actually enabled us to explore, to go on a journey together, to build something, to create intimacy. And all the time, what's firing together, wires together. What fires together, wires together. We're being fused to one another. We went out on a date last week. I was doing some calculations. We went out to see a kind of Broadway musical at the Hippodrome. It was cool. But in the interval, I was just thinking, how many dates have we been on? I worked out that we're well over 1,200. All the time, we're just building, 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 building. I asked Kate last night, when did you feel most passionate about me? Was it at the beginning in the kind of crazy phase? She said, actually, I felt most passionate about you at the 10-year mark. Well, we had been through a little bit of a difficulty. Our marriage had hit a little bit of a hump. We weren't sure whether we were going to make it. But you came and you made a commitment that you were going to stick with me no matter what. She said, my passion for you skyrocketed. And then she thought a little bit more and she said, do you know what? Actually, I think my passion for you is greater now than it has ever been. It's growing all the time. And I'm like, me too. Look, I've got one of your hairs in my pocket. And she's like, seriously, that is still weird. So let's go back to the passage. This is what Paul says to the Thessalonians, and let's try and dig it out. Let's just focus on the most important part. Holy and honorable and wrong or take advantage. Paul says this is what pure means. So our definition of being pure is that you must be holy and honorable and don't wrong or take advantage of the other person. And again, he says, look, the people around you, the people in the culture around you, they don't know God, they've got no relationship with God, and then that's fine. They can express themselves however they see fit. But you want to please God. And that means you are holy and you're honorable. You don't wrong or you don't take advantage of another person. And I want this community to be a community where we live that, where we're holy and we're honorable, where we're not wronging one another, we're not taking advantage of one another. Because if we're not careful, we can just act in a way that is like everybody else. And I want us to be better than that. I want us to have relationships within this church. And we do want you to have relationships. I'm not saying don't date, don't go out. I'm saying go for it. You know, the vision of this church is find love, follow, serve. So we like it when couples find love. Chloe and Caleb, they got married because they met each other in this church. We want you to explore this stuff. But this is the deal. You do it holy and honorably. You say, I'm not going to do anything that wrongs a person or takes advantage of the other person. You know, sometimes our dating relationships, they're not that great. There are people who feel wronged. I did this message last week, and we started off the series. And I got an email from New Zealand, from a young woman. She said, I've been watching this in New Zealand. She did it in a New Zealand accent, which I can't do. And she said, you talked about women in the culture of the church being either mistresses, concubines, or wives. She said, quite frankly, it feels like our choices haven't got much better than that. She said, how can you stop guys from taking advantage and disrespecting us? And I want to say to both men and to women, when you do your relationships, be holy, be honorable. Don't wrong them. Don't take advantage of someone. Sometimes people will say, you know, well, yeah, I did this stuff, but I checked out. She said she was okay with it. And, you know, I asked, can I do this? And she was okay. And so we did it. And you know, I didn't wrong her, didn't take it. No, you actually did. She said that because she wants to please you. And she's got this whole confusing thing going on. And she doesn't know where she is. And you just need to take one another and be really, really careful with one another. Or you might say, well, he said it was okay, and he said he didn't mind, and you know, I've had a bit more experience, and so I wanted to do this, and Josh is just leaving. It's okay. I won't talk any more about your relationships. Anyone else want to go to the toilet now? I'm joking. He is a good, honorable man. But we have these things. And sometimes it's hard. It's hard to know, you know, were they okay with it? Were they not okay with it? And so this is why Paul gives us these two words, holy and honorable. Don't worry about, well, were they okay with it? Or, you know, we were together on it. Listen, you probably had a whole host of different things. You had all this dopamine and oxytocin in your system and testosterone. And, you know, sometimes we're in situations, too much to drink. You need to draw the line. You need to be asking, God, how can I make godly choices? Is this holy? Is it honorable? Am I treating them well? We're going to finish in a minute, but I just want to give you very quickly my top way of dating. Because sometimes people say, you know, but how can we find the person? You know, it's all very well you and Kate talking about your great marriage and all of that stuff and their hair. But how do I know to find the one? You know, how do I get there? Here's three things that I always tell people. So if we put that relationship thing back up, you've got passion, intimacy, commitment. What I say to people is this. If you're looking for someone, if you're looking for a guy, looking for a girl, then put it through this lens. Talk about chemistry, connection, and calling. Okay? If you want to just whittle down the list and figure out, could we work together? Chemistry, connection, and calling. Some of you, you go into relationships, and I see them, and I think, yeah, I know that's not going to work, because I can tell they've not got the chemistry, or they've not got the calling. Chemistry means you want to catch their hair. Connection means you get on, you're compatible, you can talk. And this whole thing about you need to sleep with them in order to know, no, that just gives you more baggage. It gives you more things to work through. You're wiring into, you know, just things that you want to unwire later on. Connection is about, do we like the same things? Are we in the same kind of space? Can we talk? And you can find that out in a group setting. But calling, that's the important one. You can't really make a commitment unless you're going in the same direction as someone. So ask yourself the question, Do you have the same calling? Are you going in the same place? Are you heading for the same? Do you want the same things? Are you trying to build the same thing in life? Because if not, then don't go there. Actually, I'll be vulnerable with you, with Kate. When I first saw Kate, it's true, I was totally smitten. I told all my friends about her. But do you know what I did? I just couldn't bear to be in the same room as her because I could not keep my cool. I could not focus. And the reason I didn't want to be close to her is because I looked at her and I thought, we don't have the same calling, honey. I'm sorry, but God's called me to be a minister of the church. And you only just became a Christian a couple of years ago. So clearly, we don't fit. We're not the right match. I can't commit to you because my life is all going to be about losing my life for Jesus. So I need someone who can do that with me. And when I went out and actually eventually had a conversation with her when she told me her story, her Christian story, suddenly everything exploded in my brain because I thought, oh my goodness, she's got the same calling. She's in the same place. She's further on than me. She's more close to Jesus than me. We are going in the same place. And then we start to explore and discover, yeah, we do connect. There is chemistry. We have the calling. Some people will say, yeah, but Philip, I'm only 23 years old. I have no idea what my calling is. Okay. Well, let's talk about that. You don't know what your calling is? Don't go and date loads of people. Don't try and find out who you are or what your calling is supposed to be by trying it out with lots of other people. Actually, take the time to be on your own and figure out who you are and where you are going. And then when you know where you're going, you'll be able to find out who would be a good person for me to investigate building something with. Otherwise, you're just going to confuse yourself because you're going to be defined by these relationships and you're going to bend yourself to fit into them and you're not going to find out what you're supposed to do and what your gifts are and what your desires are. Take time out. So let's put this purity in the center. And this is a little model for relationships for you. If you're looking to explore relationships, be holy and honorable. Don't wrong the other person. Don't take advantage of them. Look for someone that you've got chemistry with, that you have a good connection with, and you don't need to sleep with them to find that out. And then, do we have the same calling? I'm going to pray in a second, but I just want to finish with this because I know that this is a download. It's a lot to take in. You might want to just watch this again on the internet. And you can talk, and that's why we have hubs. And some of the research that I've quoted, I'll put them in the notes, and you can look at that. I'm not making stuff up. I don't have an axe to grind. I don't have just an angle. I'm not getting paid for this. But we do want you to be happy. And we do want to be a community of friends without benefits, friends who love without anything expected in return, a community of loving. And we want you to take that passion, whether you're single or married, relationship or on your own. We want those sexuality impulses to be driving us towards one another, driving us towards God. Next week, please come back next week because we're going to look at the whole issue of the gay community and the faith community and how they intersect. You're gonna